Today on Backroom Politics,
more federal workers facing more federal cuts. The IMF is having all kinds of problems, and by the way, it's not just fiscal. And the GOP field gets slimmer and slimmer thanks to Donald Trump and Mike Huckabee. This is Backroom Politics, live from Shelley's Backroom. It's Tuesday, May 17th. You know something, and we're live. It's Tuesday, May 17th, 2011. We are here at live Shelley's Back Room, 1331 Sixth Street, a part of the nation's capital. Today, what is this? That means it's time for our roundtable. Hello, everyone inside the Beltway, outside the Beltway, in the nation. As we go around the table and introduce our normal. Our normal gathering of pundits here in Shelley's. I go to my left.
I don't think Bob is very normal.
Well, Bob is normal to an extent. Well, we
I'm
might.
A Republican. What do you expect?
He is normal. By the way, sitting to my left, he is the former 8-term member of Congress from Washington State's 2nd Congressional District. He is the former vice president of Burlington Northern Railways. He is the Honorable Congressman Al Swift. Al, welcome back.
Delighted to be here.
Thank you. Sitting across from me, as he is every Tuesday, almost every Tuesday, you've been gone for the past 2 weeks. He is the former floor chief for Congressman Gerald R. Ford. He is the former vice president of government affairs for the National Broadcasting Corporation and an alumni of NBC, as we just found out, huge party in New York. He is the Honorable Bob Hines. Bob, welcome.
Well, I'm glad to be back. I enjoyed my two Tuesdays away, but I'm very happy to be here.
Missing, who I believe will be calling in shortly, who normally would sit to my right, is our international pundit, Dr. Ralph Winnie. We'll be hearing from Ralph here shortly. But I got to tell you something, guys. There's a lot going on, as there is every week here in Washington, D.C. We've got our pick of subjects. We might as well start off with the obvious one that's kind of getting a little bit of buzz in the headlines today here in Washington. That is the situation with the IMF, the International Monetary Fund. For those of you who are not in the know, let us just review what's going on. The International Monetary Fund, in fact, Ralph was there and then just Ralph left. We've got to find out about that. But we wanted to get with Ralph on that, so we'll get to the IMF situation here shortly. Oh, he's back. Let's see if Ralph's on with us. Ralph, you with us?
Yes, I'm on.
Hey,
good
Ralph.
Good to be with everyone.
Oh, well, welcome back, Ralph. Where are you calling from today?
I'm calling from Hawaii. I'll be coming back to D.C. next week for one day, and then I'm heading off to the G8 for the balance of the week.
Excellent.
And so look forward to getting some more info on Dominique Strauss-Kahn and the whole situation with the IMF. Should be quite interesting.
That's what we're going to talk about here. I'm glad you're back on the line with us because we want to talk about what is happening with the IMF. For those who don't know, the International Monetary Fund, Ralph, in 2 seconds or less, can you give us a thumbnail of what exactly the IMF is and what it does? And how it's important.
Well, the International Monetary Fund basically provides aid to developing countries, helps them evaluate business development projects, and to help them establish a fiscal monetary system for developing countries.
So if the IMF, talk a little bit about what's going on with the IMF. They are having to bail out several of the EU members. Most notably, they've been bailing out Greece. I believe Ireland's in the loop. Spain, and I believe the most recent one they did was Portugal. Is that correct?
Yes, that's all correct. And it's generating a lot of controversy because, the IMF makes these loans, and eventually they have to be paid back, but many times the countries are not ready to, and they feel that the loans are very onerous, in some cases usurious. So it creates a lot of backlash among people. That's why you see a lot of people protesting. They claim the IMF is really not working for the betterment of the people, that they're working basically to promote a one-world system, a one-world currency, and helping the basically the big power brokers become rich.
Well, let's talk a little bit about what's going on with the IMF. For those of you who are not familiar with what's happening, the managing director of the International Monetary Fund, Dominique Strauss-Kahn, was taken off of an Air France flight. I mean, obviously, being the executive director of the IMF is actually not bad money. He's in first class. But the, the managing director of the IMF was taken off of an Air France flight. He has been accused of a sexual assault on a 32-year-old chambermaid in the luxury suite of a Midtown Manhattan Sofitel. Right now, he is being held without bail at Rikers Island, which is probably an environment he's not really used to. That being the case, it was also widely reported that Strauss-Kahn was going to be the socialist candidate for president of France. So this news has got to be a little bit of a relief for President Sarkozy. Why is this important? And tell me, how does this tie into, Ralph, some of the problems that the IMF is having right now?
Well, I think there's a sense among people that the people that are running the IMF are just in it for themselves, that they are sort of taking money under the table, that they are not working to improve the quality of life for people in developing countries. So there's this attitude that the people in control have all the money and they're trying to enrich themselves rather than helping, which was the mission of the IMF, which was to help countries with loan guarantees and to provide sound fiscal economic footing. The interesting thing about Dominique Strauss-Kahn, as you said, is that he was very well connected with the socialist government that was the socialist party in France that was trying to defeat Sarkozy in the next election. He would have been a very formidable candidate to Sarkozy because he's very, very well-spoken, very photogenic, and someone that did have a lot of support among the rank and file in France. When I'm at the G8, I'm hoping to have an opportunity to talk with Sarkozy's right-hand man, who I had met when he was ambassador to France, to kind of gain a little more insight into this. But I'm thinking that the Sarkozy camp is very pleased that Dominique Strauss-Kahn is out of the money at this point.
When we talk about the IMF and how it's being received internationally, we've seen a lot of the anti-globalization, a lot of the, for lack of a better term, anarchists that are out there. But generally, Al, in your term here as a former member of Congress, when you were in Congress, how is the IMF viewed? Is it viewed as the international banking institution that it was designed to be, or is it just basically government welfare for developing countries?
Well, it depends on who you are. I'm sure you could have found both attitudes in the Congress. I think most people were very supportive of what it was supposed to be. I did not serve on any committees that had jurisdiction over it, and so I am not quite sure in any kind of detail how well it was being run. But there have been the questions raised that you talked about, and this obviously cannot help the IMF.
When, in your time, Bob, you've been around Washington, D.C., and you've seen the advent of the IMF throughout its existence, is this something that's going to dampen the IMF's image as far as a global financial institution, or is this just a hiccup that they'll eventually get over because of the fact they're having to bail out a lot of the EU members?
Personally, this is a personal picadillo, if you will, by their number one person. So that's embarrassment. But fundamentally, I don't think it's going to change the focus of the organization. I don't think any of the members are going to either pull out or refuse to help fund it or any other thing that would damage the organization and its programs, because it does have a good purpose. I am sure that there are, you could, they could probably spend the money better sometimes than they do, but nonetheless, you need an organization like the IMF. It does a good job, and it will really, I think, you know, it'll be embarrassed, but that's about all.
I'm sorry, Rob.
I think it has tended to be a very good organization, but they do need to have some sort of accountability in the whole process. Anytime you have these kind of scandals that break, it does reflect unfavorably on the institution and the people that run it.
Ralph, when we talk about the IMF, you know, how does the IMF tie into the World Bank, and how does it tie into other organizations like USAID and TDA?
Well, they're all interrelated. They're all providing some sort of economic development aid programs to developing countries to ensure that they're on sound economic financial footing. I think the interesting issue, though, is that the IMF has expressed skepticism about the U.S. and our financial footing. They have said that the Age of America could be coming to an end in 2016, simply because of the growth of the Chinese economy is going to necessarily surpass the U.S. economy around that time. And the size of the deficit and the size of the debt has grown to the point of public alarm from the IMF standpoint. And they're going to be watching very closely to see how what the U.S. politicians' reaction is to raising the debt ceiling. Have a very big impact on IMF lending.
And when we talk about the importance of the IMF, is this little hiccup going to affect the economy? We've seen it kind of have a little bit of a backlash in some of the global markets. But is there a long-term risk for countries like Portugal, Spain, and Greece that are going to be relying on this?
Well, it does, because you have to pay the money back. You have to provide jobs and economic security. Most of those countries don't have a sound economic plan, and if they can't rely on the IMF, they're going to have to go look at other markets, or they're going to have to make draconian cuts, and that's going to upset their workforce, especially the unions, which are very powerful in those respective countries. So it's going to be a very, very interesting to see what happens in Portugal, Ireland, and Spain.
Well, let's take a break here. We're at the quarter past the hour. When we come back, we're going to talk about the big ticket items coming up, and that's the 2012 election and how that's starting to shape up. A lot of changes in the GOP ticket. Actually, a little bit of cockiness coming out of 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue in the past couple of days. A little private joke between the President of the United States and the Secretary of State saying, pretty much come and get me. I'm unbeatable. So we're going to talk about that when we come back. As always, we invite everybody to call in. If you're out there in Radio Land, please feel free to call in. 619-638-8477. Once again, that number is 619-638-8477. This is Backroom Politics live from Shelley's Back Room. We'll be back in 2 minutes.
Of the sun and west of the moon, we'll build a dream house of love. Moon at
From Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital of Washington, D.C. With me, as always, is the Honorable Al Swift, Honorable Bob Hines. Joining us from Hawaii is Dr. Ralph Winnie. I'm your moderator, Justin Russell. I keep forgetting to mention myself, that there's a voice out there that remains mysterious. I got to tell you, The big political news happening over the past couple of days has been the slimming down, if you will, of the GOP race for president in 2012. Most notably, the anticlimactic announcement by both Donald Trump. So I got to tell you something, and it's ironic, too. As former vice president of NBC, Bob, in your history, I mean, you have been to numerous primetime season kickoffs. Do you ever remember a presidential announcement coming out of an NBC primetime lineup?
No, and I don't think I'll ever see it again.
You're a former broadcaster. You're a former member of Congress. Was that the most anticlimactic?
Well, it was anticlimactic. And then to be anticlimactic, he says, I'm not going to run, but if I did, I'd win. And at this point, I'm thinking, call the vet. That is the lamest excuse I've ever heard.
I have got to tell you something. I mean, there's shameless self-promotion.
Well,
this is obviously, he was never serious about running. I don't care what he says. There's too much money involved for him to stay in NBC and stay on Celebrity Apprentice. It just does not make sense. And the media would have eaten him alive.
He is, it's hard for me to believe that he spent as much time as he did saying he was running and he was serious, because his history, whether you're talking his marital history or his economic history, is very clouded at best.
Right.
As far as the kind of person you say, geez, this guy seems like a pretty solid character, this guy or gal could be the president of the United States. You can't look at him and think that.
Now,
I'll bet what happened was that he did it strictly for publicity and so forth and what have you, and then got into it and kind of liked the idea and all the attention he was getting, and his ego drove him for a few weeks longer than he had intended, I think.
Well, I
couldn't stop himself.
Well, I got to tell you something. I would venture to think that he kind of saw, I mean, look, the man is the master of self-promotion. The man is the master of marketing the name and the brand Donald Trump.
Well, if you had hair like that, it'd be easy, too.
Civil, Bob. And for those of you who want to call in, please feel free to call in now. The number here is 619-638-8477.
I thought that was civil.
Maybe so. And by the way, we will not be taking phone calls from Donald Trump's hair. I can see somebody out there actually calling in as Donald Trump's hair. Going back to an old Howard Stern reference. When we look at, by the way, as the moderator, I would like to now put the Donald Trump name to bed. I am hereby declaring a one-month moratorium. We do not mention Donald Trump politically on Backroom Politics. Are we in agreement?
No, I think we should put it beyond 1 month. I don't want to ever hear it again.
Fair enough. Let's talk about the real political name that came out of the race, which was, depending on who you ask, was kind of a surprise, kind of not. That is the name of Mike Huckabee, former governor of Arkansas, presidential surprise in 2008 when he won Iowa in a pretty sizable lead. Mike Huckabee was a little bit of a shocker. Why was Huckabee such a surprise to some folks?
I think it's because he was a very good candidate, which raised expectations, and he's a very sensible man, and decided, I've done this once, and it's hard. It is hard, and I think he's got himself a television show, isn't it, or a radio show that he's doing. He can go home at night and put his feet up. Yeah, he doesn't have to charge off to Iowa in the winter and New Hampshire. And it was a very sensible decision viewed from him personally. But what the Republicans lost was a very conservative man with very soft edges.
Right.
And that
is somewhat rare in the party, and it's useful.
It's very rare with the right-wingers and because they usually have very sharp edges. And he had an excellent personality, and I think he could have flown under the right-wing rhetoric and brought in some conservative moderates.
Now, Bob, we've heard Al's side of this. From a Republican standpoint, is there a disappointment in Huckabee pulling out?
I am sure that there are. There is a reasonable number of Republicans who would find him very attractive. I think Al has expressed it well. He did well in Iowa. He would have a good start, but then he'd have to go up to New Hampshire, and he did not do well at all in New Hampshire.
Right.
And in South Carolina, as I recall, he did not do that well either. So it may be that he took a look at two things. Number one, he's got a pretty good system going, a lifestyle going right now that he's enjoying. And number two, he'd have to go through those same early states that only one of them really supported him.
Yeah. And I never understood why the Christian right, because he's an ordained minister, is he not?
Correct.
Why the Christian right were so incredibly skeptical of him. He was in the right position on the political spectrum. He was right on the issues. And he was about as Christian as you'd get, being ordained, and they didn't like him for some reason. Well, I mean, many of them didn't.
Well, I think that probably the reason that they didn't was the point that you mentioned. He didn't have that hard edge, and a lot of the Tea Party and the harder edge evangelicals, you know, like that strong, vigorous pronouncement.
Let's look at that because, you know, with the exit of Mike Huckabee, the governor's decision not to run for president in the 2012 election, does he strike you as being more flyover country? Did we lose a lot of the Midwestern Republican electorate, Bob, by him pulling out? It now becomes, for lack of a better term, a bi-coastal race?
No, I don't think we have, we'll talk later about some activity in the Midwest, which I think will indicate that I think the Republicans will do rather well in the Midwest if
certain things happen.
If certain things happen.
Okay,
yes.
We'll talk about that here shortly.
Yes.
But going back to Mike Huckabee, is Al, do you think Mike Huckabee is still going to be an influence in how the 2012 Republican ticket is formed?
I think a minor influence. I don't think he doesn't. He can't deliver a group of people. He can't deliver money. I think he can go out and speak on behalf of the candidate
but
here and there.
He won't be a particularly significant figure by the time we get to the campaign, which is a year away. I think that he will be, he'll be speaking from time to time and doing what he can because he's a good Republican. But fundamentally, I think he's taken himself out of the political world.
Well, the question to you, Ralph, is does the Huckabee name resonate internationally? Have you found Huckabee to be somewhat noted in international circles you've been around?
Not really. I mean, the few people that know of him believe him to be a Southern Baptist preacher. They don't believe he has a lot of pull or influence within the Republican Party. That being said, I think if he can continue to build his notoriety as a Fox News commentator, he could set himself up in the next few years to be a major power broker. But he has to really connect with the base of the Republican Party, which he hasn't been able to do up to this point.
Now, Huckabee's out. That leaves still some unanswered questions of several names that we'll talk about here shortly. But overall, did Huckabee have a chance in the 2012? Do you think that he truly did a gut check and said, wait a minute, Snowball's got a better chance downstairs than I do of getting elected president in 2012, particularly with the momentum that Obama's kind of got going right now, Al?
Well, I think his chances were a little less than some of the other major candidates, but given that politics is very, very unpredictable, I think if he had decided to get in and fight for it, there was a possibility.
Bob?
I think that he had a limited appeal, generally speaking, and I think that he probably would have by the time we had gone through five or six primaries, he probably would have seen that he was not going to win the nomination.
So, with that being the case, as we come up to the bottom of the hour, and we're going to take another break, but all in all, this benefits Huckabee more than it benefits the GOP. Would you agree with that, Al?
Yes.
Bob?
Yes.
Okay. That being said, we're at the bottom of the hour right now. When we come back after our break, we're going to address an article in Politico that came out today, an article by Alexander Burns, and it's five questions for the GOP race in 2012. And we're going to be talking about some of those X factors that we were mentioning during this discussion. But this is Backroom Politics, live from Shelley's Back Room. We'll be back in 2 minutes. Stay with us.
Thank you.
And we're back here live in Chili's Back Room, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. Let me give out the call-in number for those of you who are listening out there. The number is 619-638-8477. Again, that number is 619-638-8477. We're going to continue on the talk of the GOP race for 2012. Again, for those of you who are not familiar, a name who will rename who will remain nameless in this show, pulled out during his NBC primetime lineup announcement. And then also the other surprise was the pullout of Mike Huckabee, former governor of Arkansas, has decided not to run for president. But this brings up five questions that was in an article published today by Alexander Burns on the Politico website, and it's five questions for the GOP race. So, we want to take those five questions and put it to our round table. The first question that...
I get to play a Republican.
You get to play a Republican now, Al.
Good.
Actually, you know what? Actually, I want you to stay a Democrat because I would like your Democratic view on these five questions. So you have to remain a Democrat on this one, Al.
You're a much better Democrat than you are a Republican.
I would agree with that. I would agree with that.
I was only going to say idiotic things.
Wow, that was civil, Al. That was real civil. Let's talk about the first question, and this goes back to a comment that was made earlier on the show about certain things happening out in the Midwest. The first question that they've got in this article is, if not Mitch Daniels, then who? This brings up a very valid question. Number one is Mitch Daniels viable as a candidate for the 2012 election? Bob, you've been a big fan of Mitch Daniels from the beginning. You've said almost from the beginning of the show that Mitch Daniels is somebody we need to keep an eye on as a dark horse coming through in the 2012 election. Why is Mitch Daniels so attractive to the Republican Party?
Well, I think he's attractive to the Republican Party because he comes from the Midwest, which is it has traditionally been a strong part of the Republican base. He has been a successful governor, but it's not just that he's been a successful governor, but what he has done is manage the state over two terms very well. It's one of the few states that has a surplus, and he hasn't had to get into a war with the public employee unions. He's had some disagreements, but he's worked things out. Fundamentally, he's a guy who is for a strong defense, less government intrusion, low taxes, and a strong economy. Very traditional Midwestern Republican values. And that resonates, particularly because, in my view, he also stays away from what I consider to be the kind of issues that are more divisive to the public as well as the party as anything else. Some of the social issues, I don't think he doesn't really focus on those. He focuses on things that are more general and broader interest. And I think that's a strong point for him.
Al, as a Democrat here, does Mitch Daniels give you a little bit of pause as far as a viable candidate for 2012 is giving President Obama a run for his money?
Well, let me first of all say that when you ask how did the Republicans feel about it, I think Bob gave the answer of rational, moderate Republicans.
Right.
I don't think all of the Republicans, and certainly not the Tea Party and the far right, would agree, because he is not sharp-edged on the things they want. So I'd make that modification. When Bob first talked to me about Mitch Daniels, I had never heard of Mitch Daniels. And he described him as a short, bald, fat little man.
No, he's very thin.
Short, bald, and thin.
I remember him saying fat. And I've been wondering what diet he'd been using because he's a very thin little man. So I kind of dismissed this as a fantasy that Bob had. He's been coming on. More and more people, it's not so much he's coming on, more and more people are saying good things about Mitch Daniels. They're doing it for him. Where he's made appearances, they have been very successful. So I would think that the Democrats would hope for a Republican crazy, and they're not going to get one in Mitch Daniels. That, I think, is good for the country. It's not good for the Democrats in their partisan sense.
You know, I want to take one difference with Al. He indicated that a lot of the Tea Party people may not be particularly supportive of the Governor Daniels because of the issues that he's for and what he doesn't talk about, so many of the social issues. I would suggest that, you know, the fundamental Tea Party issue is about is not social issues. There are a lot of Republicans who are in favor, you know, have a lot of interest in the social issues, but the Tea Party organizations that sprung up around the country last year and the year before and were so important in the election last year really were people who were worried about the size of the government and the intrusiveness of the government. They weren't worried about gay rights or other issues like that are social issues or abortion. They were really interested in the economic power of the government, the intrusiveness of the government, and a desire to cut both of those points down, cut the government down in both those ways. So I think that Mitch Daniels may not be as exciting a politician, pounding on the table all the time, but his fundamental philosophic view, I think, transfers pretty easily into support for most of the Tea Party people who fundamentally like a small government and low taxes.
Ralph, the question to you now becomes, does Mitch Daniels have the experience internationally that would normally get big businesses domestically to back a president for 2012?
I don't think he has the international experience yet. He certainly has very strong relationships with the conservative and the Tea Party movement. I think he, as time continues to progress, I think his candidacy is just going to get stronger and stronger. Even if he doesn't get the nomination this time, he could set himself up very well for the next cycle. And that could also mean trips abroad to do fact-finding, economic development issues.
And I would point out that it is not unusual for presidential candidates to be weak on experience in foreign affairs. Most of them have to take a short course in foreign policy. I would just like to go back to what Bob said before, and he may well be right, but I think you just got to be careful of the extremes of your party, because they are not usually, they don't even think in terms of party loyalty and what have you. So he may well be right, but I would still say there's a chance they could get squirrely on that.
Well, certainly, I think this. I think the as a group, I think the Tea Party wing of the Republican Party is certainly has not made any commitment to any candidate at this point. They're very much looking for a candidate.
Why is that? Why normally by this time, traditionally, there's been at least a trifecta of front runners. Now we keep hearing Mitt Romney as being, you know, the lone front runner in many instances, but we're hearing Mitch Daniels' name pop up a little bit more. Haley Barbour has been talking to Mitch Daniels. The one person who might round out that trifecta, Chris Christie, has come out and just did everything short of tattooing it on his chest: "I am not running in 2012." But why is it that we can't get our arms being the Republican Party, wrapped around a single triumvirate of front runners?
Well, I think that the reason that we haven't had that this time, quite frankly, is that we have a group of unknowns, so to speak. Obviously, Mitch Daniel is an unknown.
Correct.
The former governor and Ambassador Hausman is an unknown. He's probably going to take a move. The only Republican who's... There are only two Republicans who were well-known who 6 months ago or 8 months ago talked like they might want to run. One was Sarah Palin, and the other one was Mitt Romney. Now, and the former governor of Hawaii, Alaska, has basically, I think, indicated informally that she's not running. She's doing absolutely nothing to indicate that she is running. And it seems to me that she's decided she has another. She's going to be a player in the game and a significant player, but not a candidate.
Well, that brings up the second question that Mr. Burns brings up in his article is, will Sarah Palin resurface as a candidate, or does she just sit there and carry on the money-making momentum that she's got now with a reality show, her agreement with Fox News, and the other paid political stuff that she's doing right now? Al?
My view is that she stepped in a bucket and she's having a hard time getting it off her foot.
I never knew Al was such a down-home fellow.
Wow, that was about as down-home as it comes, Al. I gotta tell you,
I love it.
That was pretty southern of you, sir.
I'm going to stop while I'm ahead.
But it does beg the question, though: is will Sarah Palin resurface, or has she become? And I don't like using this term. She's a former governor, former seated governor of a state in the United States. You know, has she become almost a caricature or a cartoon candidate, if you will?
Well, thanks to the help of what's the actress? I think the answer is
Tina Fey. Tina Fey.
Tina Fey is the cartoon, and it's really hard to separate.
I would say this. I think that Ms. Palin is going to be a force during the nomination process. She has a courtier, a relatively warm, hard, focused, you know, really lover group of people within the party. And I think they're going to be willing to follow her lead with respect to issues on the party planks in the platform.
Tea Party likes her.
Tea Party likes her, obviously.
And I think that she is going to have an influence in who the nominee is. I would suspect that she will decide who that is in the next few months. And I can see her being a regular on the speaking tours for her candidate.
Well, that being said, when we look at, you know, those who would back potential candidates for 2012, is Sarah Palin a good surrogate for that candidate? Al?
I am so prejudiced against her that I'd have to say no, but that's me. And she certainly will be a good surrogate for a candidate that is trying to bring those Tea Party people in if she will agree to do it.
Ralph, do you think that Sarah Palin makes a good surrogate for whoever the 2012 Republican nominee might be?
I think she has some support with the Tea Party movement, and depending on the district, she could be a force. However, the way that she's been perceived since she left the governorship, or as some people would say, quit her job, has not reflected very favorably on her. She's become more of a celebrity and more of an oddity, a curiosity, and the butt of jokes among many pundits, both in the U.S. and overseas. She's viewed as a clown, as someone that is sort of a joke. So her standing has not improved.
And what is the name of the congresswoman who...
Michelle Bachmann.
I don't think there's room in the race for both of them. And I think that if Bachmann gets in seriously, it squeezes out some room for Sarah Palin.
But how real is Michelle Bachmann, Bob? I mean, you know, she's been a relative newcomer. She got a little bit of standing, but she's almost become a caricature when she gave the alternative Republican response to the State of the Union earlier this year. Does she really have a chance of getting her name and being a legitimate candidate for president in 2012?
In order to be a significant candidate, she's going to have to do an awful lot, pick up an awful lot more support than she has now. she does not have a great deal of support.
Is she too polarizing to be a legitimate candidate?
Possibly.
Al with an opinion. Al, why do you say yes?
Well, look at what she's doing. I mean, her statements are so over the top, so extreme, that they don't show thoughtfulness. They show ideological determination without all the rest you need to back up a presidential candidacy.
Bob?
Well, I don't disagree with Al. I think that she does have some pretty sharp edges, and she doesn't have a strong enough base to overcome those the problems with the sharp edges.
Now, with Bachman and Palin being somewhat of an influence in who they drive towards the Republican nominee for 2012, this obviously begs the question. We talked about it earlier, but let's dive into it a little bit. Is the Tea Party movement? Has the Tea Party movement seen its 15 minutes of fame, or are they still going to be a viable influence as we go forward the closer we get to November 2012? Al?
I think their 15 minutes of fame will end with the 2012 election. I think they will have an effect on it. I don't know what that will be. I suspect it has as good a chance of being negative for the Republicans as it does being positive for the Republicans. And if that's the case, I do not believe we will hear of the Tea Party in 2014.
Bob?
If, as Al says, their impact is negative, I think they will drift down, because by negative, that means that they've hurt the candidate and their own membership in Congress has been seriously reduced. If that happens, yeah, they're gone. If it doesn't happen, if they are seen as a positive force that helped the party, they will continue to be a major player.
Al?
I've got a bottle of wine bet that we won't hear from them in 2014 with a friend of yours down in Florida.
Right.
She'll be made nameless. But she was of the view that they were here to stay forever, you know, and that the support was going to swell. I think all of that is incorrect. And that brings up, did you ever give Bob bottle of
no,
wine.
It's still sitting collecting dust. I actually do have to give him a bottle of wine.
It's aging very well.
Yeah. It's aging very well.
Well, you know, Red Ripple needs some aging.
But that also brings up the question of Ron Paul. I mean, Ron Paul is one that has gotten a lot of momentum. He seems to be a giant killer in a lot of these elections. Not one that gets a lot of attention as a viable front runner, but he still manages to get a lot of the media attention. He still has that isolationist libertarian view that manages to attract a lot, particularly in the Midwest, particularly in your middle class, a lot of support in the Rust Belt. Ralph, I'll go to you. Does Ron Paul have the ability to help drive some of the platform going into 2012 for the Republicans?
Well, I think he certainly can play a role, both votes away from Bachman and Sarah Palin. But his supporters are very vocal, they're very passionate, and they're willing to do the grassroots organizing, which is so effective in American-style politics. I think what's going to be interesting with Michelle Bachman is the fact that she's made a lot of inaccurate statements about various issues, and the question is, will that come back to bite her among the conservative groups, especially within the Tea Party movement?
Well, and that brings us to Newt Gingrich.
Well, that's the other player in this is Newt Gingrich. Newt Gingrich has raised a lot of money in comparison to some of the other front runners. Does Newt Gingrich, particularly with the baggage he's carrying over, he's been one that has promoted family values, and some have called into question his ability to live up to the family values. Bob, you have said before that the one candidate that has really given you a little bit of pause as a Republican has been the Newt factor. Is that still the case?
Well, Al has heard me say on more than a few occasions that I view the former speaker more as a prophet who can, you know, build the case and lead you to the promised land, but he doesn't govern well. He's more of an idea person than he is an implementer, and I just think he just is not the man it ought to be the nominee.
Al? And the media seems to have caught on to the fact that he makes up facts as he goes along. There was a big article on that in the Post this week, and that's the kind of charge that tends to stick. And if it does continue to stick, he may turn out to kind of just slip away.
Yeah, and I see that the governor of South Carolina has challenged him on his. He was discussing his position on the health care and the mandate.
The governor, Nikki Haley.
Yeah, Nikki Haley of South Carolina, and she took him on for what he said and the way he said it. And he said, you know, he's been trying to explain himself. A lot of Republicans are trying to explain himself with respect to the
that seems to be the going case. You bring up a very valid point, Bob, is with the having to explain yourself issue that a lot of the candidates are facing right now.
Romney too.
Romney too, with his medical bill up in Massachusetts. Are they spending too much time trying to explain what's happened in the past and not enough time focusing on what the actual issues today are?
No, they spent too much time doing dumb things in the past that they now have to explain.
Yeah. You know, I am reminded of Mr. Kerry's statement back in 2004. I was for it before I was against it, or whatever that, you know.
Right.
You know, that kind of problem. When you have a problem where you have to keep explaining yourself because people keep wanting to know what you're really thinking, it. Al is exactly right. Voters don't like that.
Yeah, but Ralph, when you look at a state in the electorate in where you are out in Hawaii, you know, is the past that much of a driver in the way they're thinking, or is the current issues that are hitting the headlines today in the Honolulu paper going to drive them forward in 2012?
Well, I think the Hawaii Republican Party is certainly looking at making their caucus a lot more relevant for the 2012 nomination. That's why they have changed the whole system at our last convention this past weekend on Kauai. So we're trying to make our state more relevant and to create a system similar to what the Democrats did in 2008, where they had basically an open primary and they were able to register a tremendous amount of new voters who came in and supported Barack Obama. Smaller states certainly have the need to really come out and establish themselves as being credible in the nomination process, and I think Hawaii is moving in that direction in a very positive fashion.
But Al, when you make the comment that they're spending a lot of time, you can't be in politics and have the longevity in politics that a lot of these frontrunners have without having certain decisions that they made that were, in the case of Mitt Romney, in the best interest of his state, not necessarily the best interest of the nation. Is that an argument that holds water, or are we being too naive?
No, I think it's an argument that holds water. He was the architect of it. It is very similar to Obamacare. I think it's a perfectly legitimate issue for his opponents, both on the Republican primary and in the general election, to say, now you have denounced it. Were you wrong then, or are you wrong now? I think that's legitimate. In the case of Newt Gingrich, who just makes up facts as he goes along, that raises a different kind of issue. I think what you just said does describe Romney. I don't think it describes Newt Gingrich.
Well, I mean, the same argument can be said about Michelle Bachmann. The same argument can be said about, in some instances, Tim Pawlenty. There's a lot of X factor issues that are going to come up. But again, I go back to the question of, at what point do we stop living in the past and start looking forward and saying, look, you know, stop explaining yourself of an item that you voted on or you supported 8-10 years ago. Tell us, how are you going to fix the current problems? that's got to be the question that's got to be asked of not just the GOP, but of several of the Democratic players that are involved right now. Would you agree with that, Bob?
Sure, but, you know, but remind yourself, a lot of people who are explaining themselves are not doing it because they're volunteering to do it. You know, the media brings it up. Their opponents bring it up because it's a way to hit somebody over the head and say, well, you're right then or you're right now. You know, which what's your answer?
Is the electorate, Al, is the electorate beholden to the media on addressing a lot of these issues?
Of course they're beholden to the media. For example, if the media never mentioned an inaccuracy that English said, from today forward, it will not be an issue for him. But either his opponents or the media have got to do it because that's how the public gets its information.
Is that necessarily the right thing?
For the public to get their information from the media? No. I happen to have some strong feelings about the media, and it's not the right thing. It's just that I know of no alternative.
Bob?
I know of no alternative either. I mean, the fact of the matter is, we have a free press in this country, and as long as they don't defame you or knowingly publish, you know, in fact, you know, wrong things that you've done, you can't do anything about it.
We're coming up on the top of the hour here on the East Coast, actually top of the hour everywhere. We're going to take a two-minute break. We'll come back at the 5 o'clock hour here in the East Coast. This is Backroom Politics live from Shelley's Back Room. Stay with us. Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street in Washington, D.C. This is Backroom Politics for our second hour. Joining us, as always, is Congressman Al Swift, the Honorable Bob Hines, and joining us from Hawaii on the phone is Ralph Winnie. And we're going to continue the discussion of the Republican field in 2012, and we're going to talk about the other three questions that was published today on Politico's website by Mr. Andrew Burns. And it's actually very – there are actually five very valid questions, as we've talked about the first two, that we need to ask. What is the X factor in the 2012 GOP election race? When we left, we had just talked about some of the issues surrounding Newt Gingrich's campaign. Ironically, here in the smoke-encompassed nerve center of Shelley's back room, it is no longer encrusted. I was told by an attorney friend here in town, he said, every time I hear you say smoke encrusted, I wince, because smoke doesn't encrust, it's vapor. So it is the smoke-encompassed nerve center of backroom politics. CNN.
What about smoky?
Smoky, yeah.
Yeah.
It's smoky.
It's the smoky nerve center of, that's true. The story coming off of CNN apparently is that the Newt Gingrich campaign apparently has a lot more serious issues than people were led to believe in the money raising he's done in the initial stages of his campaign. There are some serious issues that they're having to address, and I guess that'll be breaking here shortly. But let's go back to this Andrew Burns article in Politico, the five questions for the 2012 GOP ticket. The third question he asks is, will Mitt Romney's money machine scare away his rivals? Now, we're talking about a candidate who is yet to declare, but for all intents and purposes, he's in. He's raising a lot of money. I guess he just had a fundraiser late last week, which brought in $1 million on that. We're hearing $10 million now. If that is the case, does his ability to raise money give pause to the other candidates that might be in the race? For example, a grassroots person like Tim Pawlenty, Bob?
Well, obviously, one of the considerations that any candidate makes is the question of how much money can I raise and how much am I going to have to raise in order to be a significant candidate and beat the other guys or gals. And anytime you see somebody raising, as he did, $10 million in one day, that is no doubt going to make people think twice before deciding to, disrupt their family life and their personal life and run for president. So my guess is that the question is not whether it will impact, but how much impact it will have. And the point I would make is that Mr. Romney, did not do well 4 years ago, either in South Carolina or in Iowa.
Right.
And he did well in New Hampshire. Now, people may be looking at that and saying, what's he done in the last 4 years that's going to change that reality? And if nothing has changed that reality, no matter how he had more money than anybody else last time, for a long time.
The question is, will it scare his opponents? And my answer is, if it doesn't, it should.
It should scare away. Now,
it should certainly scare them. Now, whether it scare them away, but they're going to have to come up with strategies to deal with the fact that they're probably going to be outspent.
But this is a guy who raised, in the first 3 months of his announced candidacy, won $23 million in support back in 2007.
Yeah.
He did $10.25 million on a one-day phone-a-thon here nationwide.
Yeah.
That's a machine.
It's damned impressive.
I mean, and how does that play into somebody like a Haley Barbour, who is largely seen as a front runner's money raiser? Does that take out the Haley Barbour factor, particularly with his close ties to somebody like a Mitch Daniels?
I wouldn't think so. I wouldn't think it would impact if Mitch Daniels decides to run and Haley wants to back him and back him with his efforts and machine. I think he'll do it, and it'll be as effective. The fact of the matter is that right now, I think Mitt Romney is the front runner. But the fact of the matter is, he didn't perform that well the last time, number one. And number two, you know, he's got a problem, which is, I was for one version of a mandate at one point, and I'm against the mandate in this form at this point.
And in addition to that, then there are some smaller issues in which he was, I think he was for gay marriage, now he's not, and a bunch of those things where he has flipped from. We got to remember, when he ran against Ted Kennedy, he ran to the left of Ted Kennedy.
Correct.
He said, "I am more liberal than Ted Kennedy." He then didn't win that race. He got elected as governor, and he ran the state as a very liberal governor.
Yeah.
Then he had to backtrack on a whole bunch of things to build his conservative bona fides, and I think all of that is going to make what they did to John Kerry look like child's play.
Could I just make a minor comment? You, everything you said, I agree with, except one adjective. You said he ran for governor as a very liberal, I would say a moderate Republican.
There are no liberal Republicans. I agree with that.
It's pretty hard to find a real liberal Republican. He ran as what I would call a moderate Republican, which there aren't very many of either anymore.
Right, right.
I will let you two Republicans wallow in that problem.
Well, let me go out to Hawaii and ask Ralph the question on money raising. Ralph, is Mitt Romney tapping into a lot of that big money international business community that normally is going to have to be divided up amongst the Republican candidates in 2012?
Well, I think he has a very large network, especially within the Mormon community, which is very active worldwide in a lot of countries, and is very active, obviously, in the United States. Very frugal, very a strong organization, can identify people that with money and influence. The interesting thing is, people have to focus on the fact that Romney has balanced a budget. He is the person that can bring the U.S. out of their fiscal, bring the U.S. back into the fiscal situation, put the U.S. in a sound fiscal situation. And he saved the Salt Lake City Olympics from going bankrupt, and he has a proven track record as a businessman. Which should play very well within the Republican establishment. Yeah.
I just mentioned something that I think might be interesting. He's got the Mormon problem, and I think that is tragic. I don't think a man's religion should have anything to do with it. But if he raises a very large percentage of his money from Mormons, it will bring that issue back, and he'll have to deal with it again.
Well, I would venture to say that, I mean, looking back at the 2007-2008 money that he raised, it was not based on largely the Mormon network. It was based solely on large businesses going to their own to help get America more aligned with an economy that would support big business ticket items.
And if that continues to be the case, then my comment is irrelevant. But Ralph, I think, said he was raising a lot of money among Mormons, which is not unusual. And all I'm saying is there are bigots out there that will jump on that.
I agree.
But also, Ralph mentioned some things which I think are extremely important, particularly for Republican voters. Whatever else he has a very good track record as managing both businesses and government. He did a good job in Massachusetts. He's been a successful businessman. He saved the Winter Olympics.
Correct.
He's done a hell of a job in any business he's ever gotten into, and he did a damn good job of running Massachusetts.
Well, but the same could be said about Mitch Daniels. The same could be said about Tim Pawlenty.
I would say the same about him.
In terms of running the state.
Running the state,
as far as running the state. Yeah. Now, this does bring in a question. You had mentioned I think last week or the week before, that you know, some of the best presidents that we've seen as far as managing government have been former governors. Do you stand by that?
Oh, yeah. I don't think there's any doubt in my mind that remind yourself that almost every state in the union has a constitutional requirement to balance its budget every year. That is a discipline that does not exist at the federal level. Now, when you are a legislator in the Congress, as so many of our candidates are from time to time, you don't, unless you've been a governor before that, you have not had a disciplined requirement to make the hard decisions that you have to make if you're a governor. And that's really important.
Al, go ahead.
I'm in complete agreement, but I want to kind of state a principle here that I have observed over the years. We tend to think of politicians as politicians as politicians. And yet, we can all think of people who are excellent legislators who would scare us to death as administrators. And administrators who were excellent administrators who simply have no patience with the legislative system. Now, there's some people that can do both.
Is Mitt Romney one of them?
I don't know I don't know where he is as the legislative thing, but he can go a long way on his administrative capacities. He's managing working with a legislator as governor or president is a lot different than being a legislator.
Well, that brings in the question then, the Mitch Daniels question. Is Mitch Daniels has been here in Washington, served in Congress, I forget how many terms, but he also has been a governor of a Rust Belt state.
He was also the director of OMB.
Correct. We fail in the media to point out those attributes that would largely be successful as a quote-unquote head of state, his ability to work with legislative body as well as manage a government. It sounds to me like Mitch Daniels has got some strong credentials behind him that would make him almost the preeminent front runner if we were looking at it theoretically.
Well, as I said, some politicians have both skills, and Mitch Daniels may be very much one of those. That's got to help you in working with a legislative body, having been in a legislative body and understanding some of the quirks that grow out of group decision making.
But
as far as I'm concerned, Justin, what you said from your mouth to God's ears, I think that my own view is that Daniels may well turn out to be the strongest candidate we can field.
Now, Mitt Romney has done the same thing. He was very successful in dealing with Beacon Hill up in Massachusetts. Had a strong, strong base both sides of the aisle in the Massachusetts legislature. He comes from a strong state legislative background with his father being the former governor of Michigan. But, Bob?
He had all of that 4 years ago.
Good point. Very valid point. Very valid point.
I have a question.
Sure.
If Justin is speaking from himself to God's ears, is that the reason he talks so loud?
No, I'm talking so loud because I got to broadcast into the microphone.
I see. Okay.
That's why. So now then, the dealing with the money machine that is Mitt Romney, it's going to be interesting to see how this plays out. Now then, a lot of factors, depending on what CNN's reporting as far as the issues with the Gingrich campaign, how strong the money machine is with Mitt Romney, the Haley-Barbour effect, I think, is going to play in. All of that, a lot of those questions, some of those answers are going to come out on June 30th when the fundraising quarter ends and the reporting's got to go into the FEC. So that's going to be an interesting talk when those reports come out. Now, the fourth question, I think we've already addressed. The fourth question that Mr. Burns has in his article is, how long does Michelle Bachmann drag this out? Now, I think we talked about Bachmann before, but is she really dragging this out, or is this just a red herring that the media is focused on? She's just not very viable, and she'll make that decision down the road.
Doesn't make any difference how long she wants to drag it out. It doesn't make any difference.
Does that help or hurt the Republican Party, do you think, Al?
Well, I think anytime you have a loud, divisive person, you know, that's talking prominently, it doesn't help the party.
Okay, okay. So
kind of the Dennis Kucinich of the Republican Party.
Speaking of which, you heard any buzz from Congressman Kucinich out there?
I've heard one person comment on it. I think I heard him comment on it. He was laughing so hard at the time.
That going back to my tell me a story, Bob, you'll get a kick out of this. Last week's tell me a story, I actually had one. It was that Dennis Kucinich was spending a lot of time in Washington State. He was actually considering running for the newly created Washington State 10th Congressional District.
Well, it's pretty good because I suspect that one thing will happen in the Ohio legislature is his district will disappear. That's my story for the year.
So
I think everybody can agree upon that in both parties.
Now, the fifth question that Mr. Burns brings up in his article is an interesting question. And it talks about the former Secretary of Commerce, former Ambassador to China, John Huntsman. John Huntsman, the question is, can John Huntsman talk to voters? Now, the first question I think we have to ask, and Ralph, I'm going to go to you, is John Huntsman a legitimate candidate in 2012 for the GOP?
I don't think in 2012, simply because he had served time in the Obama administration. That's going to rankle a lot of the rank and file of the Republican establishment at the grassroots level who make the decision on who the GOP nominee is. Moving forward, I think Huntsman would be an excellent candidate because of the strength of his international experience. He has a very close understanding of the economic and political situation in China and would be a very good representative of the United States because China, as we all know, is such an important player in the international community. But I think 2012 is still a little early for him. He needs to stay active within the party, establish his base, and then in another 4 to 8 years could be a very strong nominee simply because of his international experience and his deep knowledge and understanding of China.
Ralph, bringing up the China question, does his connection to Beijing, does that help or hurt his potential as a candidate? Is he too closely aligned with the powers that be in Beijing?
I think if he's president, being close to the government in Beijing would be a plus for the United States. Simply because close personal working relationship in Chinese culture is the way you get things done. As far as trying to get the nomination, certainly a close relationship with China becomes very problematic for Huntsman. But that being said, I think he needs to develop his credibility within the party. And that's going to take some time. He's going to need to have a visible role. He's going to need to really press the flesh and connect with the grassroots.
Al, does John Huntsman really have a chance, do you think?
No.
Why?
Because I didn't know who he was until recently. You know, I think he's one of those names that float around in Washington, D.C. In important positions, but which draw very little publicity, but very little news and attention. I think what Ralph just said is right. He should have a 1-2 strategy and use this one to get better known and then go at 214.
Well, the one thing that Mr. Burns points out in his article is that Huntsman has not, quote-unquote, gone out and shaken hands yet, which is probably going to hurt, and he potentially has. By this time, your name's got to be out there in the mainstream, and I don't think he's mainstream enough yet, Bob.
I think that both Ralph and Al and you are right. All of you are right. I think it's too soon for him to – he hasn't got enough time to – he's been a governor, but of a relatively small state, and he doesn't have much, name recognition. I suspect there's not one person in a million in the United States who would recognize his name. Of course, that's a problem you can solve if you have a lot of money. I don't know that he's been raising any.
Right.
And quite frankly, I think that it's I think that both Ralph and Al said it better than I can. This is a good time for him to get active in the party, raise money, help the candidate, do
get
what he
name,
can.
Get his name out there and
make him viable for
maybe,
2016.
Maybe end up, you know, in a major position.
Could be.
And if, in fact, that it turns out that the president is not beatable in 2012, he... all the people who have run and tried to run and haven't made it either as a nominee or a defeated nominee, he'd be clean.
Right.
And a lot of other people wouldn't. So that's a marvelous opportunity.
Yeah, Bob brings up an interesting point. There are a lot of these candidates that are running for 2012 who are just likely not to be around in 2014.
Well, we're going to take a break here real quick. It's 20 past the hour here on the East Coast, as it is everywhere. When we come back, we're going to talk about the issue facing federal employees coming in. Bob, you had an interesting take on this earlier that you wanted to address, and the issue is there's a lot of stuff. The secure government job is not as secure as it once was, and we're going to address that when we come back. This is Backroom Politics live from Shelley's Backroom in Washington, D.C. We'll be back in 2 minutes. Stay with us. Table jumps when we come back from break, and I give him a little shot in the arm of adrenaline. Joining me as always, Congressman Al Swift, the Honorable Bob Hines. Joining us from Hawaii on the phone is Ralph Winnie. I am your moderator, Justin Russell. And we're going to talk a little bit right now about an issue that's facing a lot of government workers, not only here in D.C., but nationwide, with the hitting of the debt ceiling coming up very quickly. the question of government spending becoming a prime issue going forward here in the next few months, federal workers are now facing more cuts. There has already been talk about several options. The one talking right now is a two-year pay freeze to all federal employees, which is not voting well with a lot of the federal employee unions. Apparently, in a meeting with OMB and the White House, several of the unions have gotten together and taken a look at this, and I think this, more so than anything, shows the seriousness of the fiscal condition of the country as a whole and the importance of the debt ceiling crisis. Bob, you, before we came on board, you were talking a little bit. You had some ideas on this as we were going forward. You wanted to talk about and how it interacts.
Well, today, I think today is the day that we hit the debt ceiling.
Is that today?
Today we hit the debt ceiling. It was the Post had an editorial about it. We hit a $14,299 billion, you know, million, whatever it is, but that's where we hit it today. Now, it appears that the doing what we have done in the past in situations like this, we have another 6 weeks maybe where we can maneuver things around so that we can move money from one account to another and in effect cover our obligations. But we are there. Now, it seems to me that one of the things we're going to have to do, there are how many different groups trying to find a solution? We've got the Biden group, we have the Gang of Six in the Senate, we have a House version of what should be done. The president has a bill on the table.
We have the Paul Ryan.
We have the Ryan that passed the House. We have the Erskine Bowles, Al Simpson package.
Right.
We have the Pete Domenici, Alice Rivlin version. There are all kinds of proposals out there. And one way or another, we're going to have to take some real hard decisions. We were talking earlier about one of the benefits of being a governor, because you have the discipline of meeting a balanced budget every year. And we haven't had a balanced budget in a hell of a long time in Republican administrations and Democratic administrations. We just haven't.
Bill Clinton, that's the last balanced budget that we've seen.
And one of the reasons he was able to balance the budget was because George H.W., the first George Bush, you know, raised some taxes.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
And the economy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so, you know, the reality is that we have a real serious problem. Man, take, for example, I was reading an article in the paper today talking about Social Security. You know, the report was that we're out to 2036 before we run out of money. Okay, that's not the problem. It's the cash flow. We are $76 billion below what we estimated just 18 months ago was going to be the cash flow in the Social Security this year.
Right.
We're not even close. We're $76 billion in the hole.
Well, Al, with all the options on the table, we still, and this is a message we continue to talk about, we still fail to see leadership in the House or the Senate of anybody taking the reins and saying, look, this is the proposal we're going to go forward with jointly. We got to get out of this mess.
Exactly. Bob just listed all of the options that are currently on the table, and I don't know of any one of them that is being pursued except Paul Ryan's, which has passed the House.
Correct.
Nobody wants to touch the others. All of those others are going to cause a lot of pain for a lot of people. They're going to have tax increases in them, which is going to ideologically upset Republicans. They're going to have some social programs, which will ideologically get the Democrats. And they are all going to take away something from almost everybody. Now, the question here is government employees. What bothers, and let me say, yes, and nobody is working on those. You're right about there's no guts in Congress. But let me say a word about government employees. First of all, I think the average citizen's view of the government employees is the guy that works at the post office and somebody who's pushing some paper around, in Indian Affairs.
Right.
We have scientists. The government employs almost every kind of person you can think of, and they have high values out in the private sector.
Right.
To hold those people, you've got to pay them something. I'm stating that just as general information. I see no reason at all that the public employees shouldn't take a hit like everybody else. The problem is that those who are proposing it are not talking about everybody else. They're talking about government employees, because very few people out in Dubuque are going to defend the public employees. So we need a general attack, and I would be the last one who objects to delays or freezes or whatever on government employees if in some way all other Americans are also dealing with the problem. Well, there's nothing magic about government employees.
Well, now the 2-year pay freeze has already been approved by Congress,
yeah.
Mind you.
It's in place.
It's already in place.
Because it's easy.
That is easy. Yeah. Now, the voluntary furloughs, possible layoffs of quote-unquote non-essential government employees...
Also easy.
...is very easy, but it does not bode well with... For example, the unions, it does not bode well for those constituents who are receiving services, like the person who's manning the Social Security office in Melbourne, Florida.
But here's the problem. We are starting to cut spending without a plan.
Yeah.
We're starting to cut spending wherever it's easy without laying out an overall plan of how we're going to deal with this. And in an overall plan, you can say to the government employee, but look what's happening to these people. You're not alone. The way we're going about it, without an overall strategy, you can well leave the easy ones getting cut and everybody else getting off scot-free.
And that's the secret here of the solution. And I, without necessarily recommending the Erskine Bowles Alan Simpson proposal, the fact of the matter is they did a pretty good job of taking a bite out of all the entitlement programs and all the other spending programs, and so that everybody got nicked, but nobody had an arm cut off.
Well,
and
but
see, that's the problem. Everybody says, "Don't touch me! Don't touch me!" Take for example. Someplace I saw the let's say whatever the amount of money we have in agricultural programs, three quarters of it goes to a very few wealthy big commercial operations. It doesn't go to the family 500 acres out there in Iowa or the rice farmers in Arkansas or something else. It just doesn't. Now, what that means to me is the great big guys probably could take a cut, but not the little guys, and that's how it ought to be done.
Some means testing. I think we're in for a big amount of need for
means testing. Is going to be the answer long term, but it's awfully hard to do it.
But Bob, Al, I have to put out, you look at, and I agree with you, Al, when you say we're kind of doing this in the blind. We're making cuts in the blind without an end game to focus on. And trust me, when we talk about there being several plans out there, I mean, we have a whole Sunday brunch buffet of possibilities that we could pick from to come up with one unifying financial crisis solution. And that doesn't seem to be the case yet. We see one of the proposals coming out of OPM is doing away with federal pensions and allowing employees to maintain a 401k and maintain salary preference. But you take away the pensions, that's going to have a huge effect on a very large constituency inside the retirement community.
Yeah, but not nearly as large as the constituency of all the private company employees who are on the same program, 401ks. The world has changed in the part of the economy which is the free enterprise system.
And
it's,
you know,
fundamentally changed.
It's funny that we're talking about this. CNN is just now reporting that Senator Coburn has quit the Gang of Six reform effort. Senator Coburn is out. That's a huge hit.
That's unfortunate.
Why would Senator Coburn want to pull out of the Gang of Six, do you think?
Well, we'll know by tomorrow because someone will ask him that question.
Al, as a former member, what do you envision as being a possible reason? Is it just general overall frustration? Is it the fact that he's spinning his wheels possibly? Or is there a deeper lying reason?
I have. Obviously have absolutely no idea. I assume that the direction that the negotiations are taking have gone beyond his flexibility. That's the best guess I could make.
Yeah, I would think that he has certain bottom line requirements, and they can't meet them.
We've got a phone call at 202. You're on the air. Call from the 202. And we just lost a caller from the 202. Ralph has joined us again. Ralph, you're just hearing the news that Senator Tom Coburn from Oklahoma has quit the Gang of Six. Do you think that that's going to send a message to the international business community that we really don't have our hands wrapped around the fiscal crisis?
Certainly that's not a good sign. Countries are really looking to see how the U.S. is going to react, of course, to the country's financial situation. As I've said before, the Chinese have been trying to diversify away from the dollar, and that is a big worry to the Obama administration. And the Chinese now are looking at a place like Singapore to become a trading hub for the yuan, or otherwise known as the RMB. So the key is for the politicians in Washington, D.C. to really understand that their actions have an impact internationally and to focus on getting the fiscal situation in order. And that's going to mean painful sacrifices on both the Republican and Democratic side to accomplish this objective.
Yeah, we're sitting here and, you know, we can only speculate as the news is just now breaking, but Tom Coburn, he's one of the more sensible Republicans in the Senate. I get a wince from the Democrat here at the table. In my view, I've always viewed Senator Coburn as being, when it comes to fiscal matters, one of the more sensible members of the Senate that truly had the steam and truly had the mettle to go forward in trying to come up with some sort of bipartisan solution to move forward with.
I was surprised to find him in the group of six, and therefore my attitude toward him may well have been wrong. So you may be right, but I have a hard time. It sticks in my throat to say he's a moderate.
Say it.
He is not a moderate.
He's not a moderate.
But I'm very sorry that he, you know, he was one of the people who created the Gang of Six.
Right, which is even more surprising of his departure
and
from the Gang of Six.
And he is a very principled person. He has very strong views, but he is always willing to talk. And obviously, the rest of the group is moving in the direction which he finds unacceptable, which I'm unhappy that he is leaving, because I figure that if Coburn is in there, it's going to send the kind of message to a lot of conservatives and a lot of Tea Party people that this effort is a good effort. It's an effort that can resolve the problem. And if Coburn pulls out, which he has apparently, and he says why he's pulled out, it will probably have some influence, unfortunately, that will make it more difficult to reach an agreement.
Are we taking two steps back more than we're taking any steps forward
right
now?
We're not taking any steps at all. I mean, I am so frustrated with the administration and with the House and the Senate and their leadership in both parties.
Everybody.
Because we started this whole thing, if you remember right, about saying everybody was afraid to put their toe in the water because they'd get blamed. Well, Paul Ryan put his foot in the water and he got blamed. Even some of his Republicans don't like it because... he did some things to that they heard a lot of anti stuff about when they were home recently. Well, that tells me he's doing something right. Now, I might not buy his whole thing. I'm sure, as a more liberal Democrat, I would certainly want to make negotiate compromises on some of his proposals. And I would rather see something else put in. I happen to know Senator Simpson, and I have a lot of respect for his common sense.
Yes.
And Erskine Bowles has a reputation. I don't know him. But it seems to me that's a place to start. Rivlin is a place to start. There are all kinds of places to start. Nobody wants to start. Nobody wants to join Paul Ryan with his foot in the water, and that's the step that's got to be taken by somebody.
You know what? I got to make an observation here, because I don't think that it's going to come out, but I think it needs to be said. Yesterday, Chairman Paul Ryan announced that he was not going to go after the vacant Senate seat in Wisconsin vacated by Senator Cole, which leads me to believe that out of all of the leadership in Congress right now, both on a House and Senate side, he's the one who's actually putting more skin in the game than anybody else. He's foregoing a Senate run, which arguably would have been a shoo-in for him had he wanted to. He's really made it at least peripherally known. He is in this fiscal game for the long haul.
You know, and I really agree with that. When I saw that Mr. Cole was going to retire, I thought to myself,
that's Ryan's
the most popular guy in the state right now, the most well-known guy in the state, let's put it that way, is probably Paul Ryan.
He may no longer be the most popular.
He may not be the most popular, but the point is, he probably could have had the nomination, and given the structure in the state right now, he might well have won. I think it's something to be said for him and his integrity that he wants to see this thing through as the chairman of the Budget Committee in the House of Representatives.
But,
I give him a lot of credit for that.
But yet, when you look at particularly the Republicans in the Senate, you look at those players, they look at him as almost a pariah for putting forth a budget bill that, you know, doesn't necessarily agree with big business ideals.
Listen,
Al, go ahead.
Listen here. If anything is going to get done on the Hill, both parties need to send their paladins, their hired guns, to some retreat somewhere where they could talk about how they're going to win elections and get the hell out of policy. I have never known a hired gun to care about policy. They can tell you all the bad things that are going to happen to you in the election if you do X, Y, or Z. But they're no help in figuring out what you should do to solve a problem. And I think over the years, the hired guns have developed an enormous amount of influence on the policymakers. And they have no interest whatever in what is good policy for this country. That's not their job.
Hear, hear.
And they shouldn't have been let in to where they have that much influence in the policy makings. That's what the members are hired to do.
But when we talk about the different initiatives that are out there, and we started this discussion talking about some of the financial stresses that are facing the federal worker base right now, the federal employees, but it touches on a much larger problem here in Washington. When we look at the names of the elder statesmen and those who have been inside politics, for many decades in some instances, there's a lot of quote-unquote pragmatists that are on these names. I will tell you right now, the Simpson-Bowles issue, both Simpson and Bowles have been widely regarded as being practical people here inside the Beltway. But yet, when we see all those names, not one of them, of all the options that are out there, has gotten any traction, even with the fact that they're saying, look, this is the right thing to do. How do we get around that, Al?
The reason is, you can have an old gray head like John Dingell, who knows how to do things and everything, but he's not in a position to do them. So he's not going to stick his head up over the fence and get shot.
Well, John Dingell has got his own issues. He's got to worry about a consolidated congressional district where he may be on the outside looking in.
All of that, but that's true. But it's irrelevant to my point.
Oh.
My point is, he is not in a position in Congress now to be able to lead in this area. But I'll bet. If you went up and sat down privately with John Dingell and said, what the hell should we do, he would have a plan.
But privately getting the work done. That's the problem.
Let me jump in to just say it this way. We talked about all these different proposals, plans, possible ideas that have been floating around. There are five or six of them. We are getting to the point where we have to stop sitting in small groups and working these things out, and we have to start getting to the point where we say, okay, this is it. This is our project. This is our proposal. If we don't do that pretty soon, and I mean pretty soon, next couple of weeks, we are really in deep crap.
Well, Ralph, I mean, you know, this begs the question. I mean, with not just the impact it's going to have inside our own federal government, but the international impact economically worldwide, particularly with those governments that rely on the dollar as their currency of record, the ripple effect on nobody taking leadership is going to have a global impact. Would you not agree with that, Ralph?
Absolutely agree. You're going to see more and more countries trying to divest themselves away from the dollar. China is already trying to take the lead on that. And OPEC is watching the situation very, very closely to see how we deal with the debt ceiling.
Well, Ralph,
we're eventually going to have to raise the debt ceiling, but I think you're going to have draconian cuts,
Ralph, along
the way.
Ralph, let me ask a question. Who are the other?
Hello.
Ralph, who are the other?
Yes, I'm here.
Who are the other countries that are looking to go away from the dollar as the currency of record?
You're looking at Russia is one. You're looking Singapore, Japan. So many of the countries in the Middle East are trying to dive away from the dollar.
Those are all major market players, is what you're telling me.
Absolutely. I think American countries, some of the BRIC countries, Brazil, all of this has a negative effect on our fiscal situation moving forward. The Japanese, as we've said before, are going to have to cash in their treasury bonds to pay for the damage to the earthquake. So that's going to cause a ripple effect in our economy and other economies around the world.
So the bottom line here is that with all of the evidence out there that's saying, look, the longer we stall, the longer we stop looking at an end game, the more painful it's going to be long term. These arguments, this evidence isn't resonating with anybody, let alone the White House, let alone Congress, let alone any of the candidates on the GOP ticket. Is there a way we can fix this without going to the extreme of saying, hey, let's segregate all of the hired guns and just lock everybody in a room on Capitol Hill and saying, fix this?
I don't know. We screwed this up early on, and whether we can get back and unscrew it and do it again is highly unlikely.
Bob, do you see us being able to unscrew this?
Yeah, I do.
How?
Well, because, as an example, now listen to what Ralph just said. The Japanese are going to have to cash in their bonds in order to, you know, in order to take care of the problems they've got from the tsunami and the nuclear disaster. Well, look, you know, one of these days, we have all these major, as you well said it, and Ralph identified them, all these major companies or organizations, groups, that are willing to play around with let's go someplace else than using the dollar as the international exchange. The fact of the matter is, if the guys and gals up on Capitol Hill and the guys and the gals downtown, the Treasury and the White House, don't understand that this is a situation where we are just about putting ourselves on the edge of a cliff, that we're about to get pushed over, if we walk out, if we can't solve this problem ourselves, we're standing on an edge of the cliff, and they can just push us over, and we are then doomed in a lot of ways to become not who we are today, but just another player in the bigger picture and not the biggest player at all, not even close.
Does that resonate with the Hill, do you think, Al? Or are they just walking around with blinders at this point?
I think they're all listening on how to get reelected.
Ralph, wow. am I too negative?
No, I think you're right on. We're living in a global economy. The U.S. has to compete with other countries. We cannot rely on our military superiority or economic superiority any longer. We have got to recognize that we have to get our fiscal situation in order. The Chinese understand that this has an impact in our ability to have an effective business and personal relationship with them. We also need to send a message that we are serious, and with so much so many different competing plans, there's so many different ideas, but nobody has really come to the forefront and said, this is the plan, this is what we have to do, and put a timetable. And I think the international community is going to want to see some sort of time frame clearly established. We cannot just continue to push this along slowly, trying to deal with different competing interest groups that feel that their needs have to be met. The bottom line is we have to get our fiscal situation in order. If not, we are going to go through a terrible time within the next few years. They're going to be the ones that are going to ultimately suffer.
Al, you had a comment?
Yes. Paul Ryan and therefore John Boehner, therefore the Republicans in the House, have put their foot in the water. They've made a proposal. I have not heard of a Democratic response, counter proposal from the White House or from Harry Reid or from Nancy Pelosi. You can't solve a problem on which you disagree if you haven't got another side articulated with some specifics. There is no guts, and I want to say that there are 535 people on the Hill with no guts. What I'm saying is that the leadership doesn't have the guts, because you've got to be in leadership to make it happen. A backbencher can have all the guts in the world and propose things, and it's not going to happen.
Right.
But you've got to look at the ranking members. The ranking members of the committees in the House and the chairman of the committees in the Senate and the leadership in the Senate, and say, where is your idea? How the hell are you going to do it? And then you've got something you can start a negotiation.
Yeah. Bob?
Well, early today, I said that one of the interesting things that hasn't been talked about so much is the fact that while the Democrats say, okay, we'll have some cuts, but we got to have tax raises too, and there's a lot of senators who are running for re-election who really don't want to vote for taxes. I suspect there are a lot of House members, and that may be one of the reasons it's nothing's happening. There may be a lot of Democratic House members who don't want to vote for too many tax increases.
So, right.
Well, the point is, everybody has to put their foot in the water. Al is 100% right.
Right.
Everybody's got to put their foot in the water. I'm not so sure that, you know, that you can pass the Paul Ryan proposal through the Senate no matter what happens. But you got, Al's right, where is the Democratic solution?
Right.
Now, it's fair to say that the Democrats are leading several groups that are trying to, there are several groups that are trying to work the solution out. There's a lot of people trying to, hopefully, one of these days, we're going to get some people coming down and sitting and talking and saying, this is what we're proposing.
Right. Al, you had a last comment.
My last comment is, we've got to, I don't know how you do this, but if I had the power, I would hypnotize the entire Congress so that they would believe this. You came here to solve problems. You didn't come here to get reelected.
Now, we're going to let that be the last comment this week. we got 4 minutes left. We're going to do a quick tell me a story because I know, Bob, you've got one. I would venture to say it, Al. Ralph, you probably have one too. I'm going to start with Bob real quick. 3 minutes. Make it quick.
There is a freshman senator from Ohio by the name of Rob Portman.
Right.
He has had several significant jobs and administrations here in Washington in the past, including director of OMB. He really understands the budget. He really understands finance. He's a very moderate, sensible guy within the Republican mainstream. And he is a low-key, no, you know, not a big screamer or yeller. He is in his first year of his first term in the Senate. I think that by the time his first term is up, he will be a member of the leadership. That's how highly regarded I think he is.
Wow. So he's definitely an up-and-comer in the party.
He's an up-and-comer.
Wow. Ralph, we got 3 minutes left. You got tell me a story?
Yes. We have an open Senate race in Hawaii. Senator Akaka, as everyone knows, is stepping down. There's a lot of speculation as to whether former Governor Linda Lingle is going to throw her hat into the ring as the Republican nominee. She said she's going to make her decision at the end of August, and my prediction is that she's going to jump into the race.
The story is that Linda Lingle, the former governor of Hawaii, will probably run for the vacated Danny Akaka seat in the Senate. Al, do you have one?
No, I don't, so I'm going to save you some time in your 3 minutes.
There we go. Well, we're actually down to 2 minutes here. So
Well, then I have one.
No, you don't. You never have one, Al.
Yes, I have one, but unfortunately, we'll take 5 minutes.
Oh, you see, we don't have time for that. So, on behalf of Congressman Al Swift, the Honorable Bob Hines, Dr. Ralph Winnie, I am your moderator, Justin Russell. This has been Backroom Politics, live from Shelley's Backroom, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital. Join us next week, every Tuesday from 4 to 6 Eastern Time on Blog Talk Radio for Backroom Politics. We have no major announcements coming up, but we'll probably have a couple coming up soon. So, on behalf of everybody here at Backroom Politics...
About what?
On behalf of everybody here at Backroom Politics and Shelley's Backroom, thanks for joining us. We'll see you next week, live from Washington, D.C.
Take care, everybody.
Take care, everybody.